whole stress hormone world, predominantly the glucocorticoid one, is a tendency, a very delayed tendency in humans towards resting levels of glucocorticoids rising and a longer recovery time after a stressor is over with, and we know by now all the bad things that happen. So what's the price of these elevated glucocorticoid levels that you see in old age? There's no problem, no challenge here in coming up with all sorts of versions of it. One very sort of striking one, extremely interesting one, was work done some years ago by Heather Cameron at the National Institutes of Health. And looking at that revolution we heard about earlier on, that business that, no, it's not the case that the adult brain doesn't make any more neurons, there is adult neurogenesis in the hippocampus, as we heard. Maybe it's essential for certain types of learning. And what she has observed is the rate of neurogenesis in the hippocampus goes down during aging. And in a very clever, insightful study, what she did was, well, we've got these aged rats with their elevated glucocorticoid levels. What if we turn their glucocorticoid levels into the sort you would see in young rats? And you do that, and the rate of neurogenesis pops up again. What's happening is those elevated glucocorticoid levels with age are one of the factors inhibiting senescent neurogenesis. And that's pretty interesting. So we've seen now the first half of this sort of story that's been set up, the notion that aging is a time of life where you don't deal very well with stress, cellular evidence, organismal endocrine evidence, what the glucocorticoid profile looks like. And what we've seen is you pay a price, less DNA repair, less ability to regulate temperature, less cognitive ability that's rapidly available to you, and all the prices that are paid by having excess of glucocorticoids. So now let's switch to the second half of these sort of twin theories. The notion that not only is aging a time of life where you don't deal very well with stress, but lots of stress over the lifetime can accelerate the aging process. And it turns out there's plenty of support for this idea as well. Let's start off with an extremely dramatic version of it, which is mostly just flashy, but ultimately quite informative. Now, any of us who endlessly watch all those National Geographic specials, there's all these realms of animals doing amazing, phenomenal, heroic tasks. And this is the world of like male penguins standing on top of the egg all winter long while mom is out shopping. And this is the world of like desiccated camels going weeks and months without water. All of which fall under this sort of umbrella of, wow, animals do some amazing things. And out in that world of heroic, National Geographic-worthy animal sort of exploits, one of the most amazing ones is salmon. Salmon, when they come back to spawn, and that whole world of swimming upstream and leaping over dams and all of that, and it's extremely impressive. Here's another thing that's extremely interesting about salmon, which is they go and spawn, they get back to where they were born, the pond, whatever, and they get back there, they spawn, they lay their eggs, and a week or two later, all the salmon are dead. What is that about? This is termed a programmed die-off. The process of spawning, mating, sets this rapidly emergent clock into action, which kills you a couple of weeks later. What is this about? And it turns out there might be some evolutionary logic to this. There's all sorts of theories. For example, the notion that after dying, what the purpose of this is the salmon's body disintegrates and leaves all sorts of great nutrients from the body on the floor of the water there, and the new guppies and new puppies and whatever you call baby salmon, they now have stuff to feed on. This is a model that reminds me actually of a talk I once heard by a very accomplished neuroscientist who was giving a talk to a bunch of young scientists and sort of telling them not about the technicalities of the science, but instead telling them about how you do a career in science, that sort of advice. And at one point, one of these starting off in the field young scientists said to the guy, well, what could somebody in a senior position like you do in order to help out this younger generation? And his answer was, die. die and get out of the way. One of the leading theories as to what this program die-off is about is salmon get out of the way for the next generation, and in fact, their body parts feed the next generation, you know, all sorts of evolutionary theories. But now you ask, why does this program die-off occur, not at the level of evolutionary explanations, but instead at the nuts and bolts level of what's going on in the body? What is it that happens right after salmon spawn that send them hurtling into this inevitable program death soon afterward? And a number of decades ago, people got the answer to it, and this is so interesting and instantly makes a lot of sense: glucocorticoids. The second those salmon spawn, they've got an explosion of glucocorticoid secretion like nothing you see elsewhere in the animal kingdom, and it just goes blasting through the roof, and you better bet at this point that you can make a long list of what goes wrong in these guys. They get immunosuppressed, they have hypertension, they get parasites, they get ulcers, they probably get depressed and get cognitively impaired and all that sort of stuff. It is driven by this burst of glucocorticoid secretion in the aftermath of spawning. How do you know? And now you do a really striking study. You take these salmon, and right after they've spawned, you go in there and you adrenalectomize them. You take out their adrenal glands. You take out the source of their glucocorticoids, and instead of dying 2 weeks later, they live another year. Here we have this programmed process of accelerated aging. What's weirdest of all is it's not just salmon who have evolved this. There's all these Australian marsupial mice where after they give birth, they're all dead 2 weeks later, and then there's some sort of eels that migrate back to the Sargasso Sea, and I actually haven't a clue where the Sargasso Sea is and why eels do this, but they've got the same deal as well, which is programmed death, and remarkably, it's the same mechanism. Again, it's this burst of glucocorticoids right after that period, which gets you old really fast. And what we see is here, at least three times evolutionarily, in totally different branches of the animal world, eels and fish and marsupial mice, if for whatever strange evolutionary reason there is that you want to get old really fast, the way to do it is with lots and lots of glucocorticoids. Really a remarkable finding. Despite that being remarkable and all the insight and fascination of this, we're not salmon. Most of us are not Sargassian eels or marsupial mice, and our process of aging is nothing dramatic like that. What's it doing in terms of response to stress? And what is seen by now is a very substantial literature supporting that notion. Naturally, back when, it started off not as data, not as actual findings, but instead lots of theorizing, and Cellier was the very first to start this with all sorts of wear and tear models, which made perfect sense, lots of stress, and that will accelerate the aging process, and that was wonderful and heartwarming, wear and tear as the core of aging. The trouble, of course, was nobody knew biologically what wearing and tearing is about. These were very undefined terms. In the aftermath, some other scientists put a lot more sort of structure to these notions of wear and tear, the notion of using up certain amounts of adaptive energy, resiliency, and this was only slightly less than mythology and folktale in terms of being able to translate it into actual science, but very soon you just got all sorts of versions of the faster you are exposed to all sorts of stressors, the more severely so, the faster you're going to get the little bits of cardiovascular problems and metabolic problems and all the stuff we know oh so well by now. So lots of theoretical reasons why that should be the case. What's the actual evidence for the notion that lots of stress will accelerate the aging process? And by now, there's tremendous amounts of evidence. Some of it we heard about earlier, the work of Sonia Lupien in University of Montreal, that business about looking at these populations of aged humans where she's able to do the gold standard of these sorts of studies, a longitudinal prospective study. It's the same folks that she studies year after year, and what she sees is a history of lots of stressors and the cognitive decline of aging is accelerated. So that's not good. another version of this, a closely intertwined one, and another scientist that we've discussed earlier, Michael Meany of McGill University, you'll recall that he did that research where you pick up the baby rats and you neonatally handle them and you put them back with mom and mom is more attentive as long as it's a very short period. And what he discovered was that these animals have a much more successful old age. That what you see is get the right amount of neonatal stimulation and in their old age, they won't have lost as many hippocampal neurons. Their cognition is better, their health is better, and all sorts of things work better. And what's the mechanism for this? And this was actually some work I did in collaboration with Meany. What is one of the most interesting consequences of that neonatal handling mentioned earlier on? As an adult, you've got lower basal glucocorticoid levels. And what you see is, over the course of a lifetime, lower those levels, lower the cumulative exposure to glucocorticoids, and you get older slower. Another version of support for this notion, stress can accelerate the aging process. More evidence. Now we've seen that stress can increase the likelihood of metabolic wear and tear. We've already heard this one, a very specialized type of stress. Remember back earlier, those Dutch hunger winter fetuses. This was stress very early in life, prenatal starvation, and what that set these individuals up for is a body which, thanks to its changed thrifty metabolism, hurdles you at a highly significantly higher rate towards some of the diseases that are more common with aging. As we saw, metabolic syndrome, obesity, hypertension, diabetes, yet another realm. And what experiments have shown since then is it's not just the prenatal stress and stress throughout the lifetime, and you are accelerating, you are increasing the likelihood of these metabolic diseases of aging. And that makes perfect sense. Deprivation at any point in life, and you are going to set yourself up with all sorts of stressors, the increased appetite afterward. We heard that before, the role of glucocorticoids in the recovery phase of appetite. And what that's going to do is give you a bigger girth and make you more of an apple, the abdominal fat, and make you more likely to get those metabolic diseases of aging. Final example. And this is a study that's gotten an enormous amount of attention in the recent years since it came out. And this was work done by Alyssa Eppel at UCSF. And this was the same scientist who did some of the work referred to earlier about stress profiles in people who have lots of abdominal fat. This was an area of research she moved into subsequently. And this is one that has just taken the field by storm. You got your DNA. And long stretches of DNA form chromosomes. And turns out they're fragile in all sorts of ways. And one of the ways they are is this is like a long string of genetic information. It's like a shoelace. It's wrapped around all sorts of stuff. But it has this potential problem of fraying at the ends. And this is always the metaphor everybody uses, so I'm obliged as well. What you thus have to have at the ends of your chromosomes are the same thing as you get on your shoelaces, those little plastic layered wrappy things which stabilize the end of your shoelace DNA, keep them from fraying. And it turns out that these exist, and these are called telomeres. Telomeres is the stabilizing end of DNA, and in fact, the discovery of them resulted in the 2009 Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine. Incredibly interesting stuff. So telomeres, this is not a part of DNA that codes for a gene. This is just a little plastic wrapping at the end of the long shoelace of DNA. And what you see is, over the course of time, the telomere shortens. It gets a little bit more frayed. It shortens, and when it eventually gets to the point where it's short enough, frayed enough, that there's no longer really a functional telomere there anymore, the DNA gets all ratty and ragged and all of that, and the cell has hurtled into some degree of genetic senescence. Now, this is a version of DNA damage, and as we already heard about, there's DNA repair enzymes. There's a specialized one in this case, which fixes telomeres as they're getting shorter, an enzyme outrageously called telomerase. And what telomerase does is, as the telomeres get shorter, they build them back up again. That's great. What EPL did was show that sustained stress disrupts the activity of those telomeres, and thus the telomerase, that enzyme that fixes them, isn't working as well. The telomeres get shorter faster. Now, what was the most remarkable thing about this finding? It was something that broke one of the standard patterns of laboratory science, which is you first study something in rats, then non-human primates, and eventually see does it work in humans. Her very first subjects were humans. Healthy young women who were the mothers of children with chronic diseases of some sort, where they were the primary caregiver, enormously stressful, and what you see was accelerated molecular aging of the DNA. So what we've seen here is plenty of evidence for the two halves of the story. Aging is a time of life where you don't deal with stress very well. Lots of stress accelerating the aging process and the dread possibility of a vicious cycle. This is awful news, awful news. Stay tuned. It's not all awful news.
Lecture 17, Understanding Psychological Stress.
If you ever spend a lot of time hanging out with physiologists, and I'm not necessarily recommending this, but you'll notice something, which is physiologists love toilet bowls. They're wild about toilet bowls. They dream of them. They spend their childhood taking apart toilet bowls. When they sleepwalk, they wind up there. They paint toilet bowls. Toilet bowls teach you everything you need to know about the body as far as physiologists are concerned. So here's what happens in a toilet bowl when you take the lid off and you've got your microscope going there. You flush the toilet and you've got a problem. You have a problem, which is a depletion of water. Your toilet bowl is dehydrated. It needs to fill up with water. And fortunately, you have a source of water, which is the source of water spraying the water out thing. You've got the pipe there, which goes and secretes water. And as we introduce a term here, that will come back to seem quite relevant. So you've got the first step there in a toilet bowl doing its thing. It secretes something that is necessary, which is water. So water is pouring out, and eventually the water level begins to rise, and there's something in a toilet that senses what the level is of water in the system. The flotation device there, which begins to go up as it heads up there. The next thing you have as a critical feature is a set point in the system, which is an optimal level of water, a notion as to how high water levels should go before you turn off the source of the water, before you turn off the secretion of the water. And the final thing you have is a mechanism that turns the information about water height, that sensor, the floating thingy, and what that is able to do is transduce the we've gotten up to the set point level into a signal to stop the source of water. And what we have here is what toilet-oriented engineers might call a negative feedback system, where you send a signal out and you have to have a set point, and when you reach that set point, that turns off the secretion of that. And there's just all sorts of physiological systems that work that way. Your brain decides how much growth hormone you want to have in the bloodstream, one of those hormones, whatever, and it goes and secretes it by way of this sort of whole axis we've heard about. And what it needs to do then is measure how much of the stuff there is in the circulation. It needs a flotation device. And what that is parts of the brain that are sensitive to levels of that particular hormone. There's got to be a set point, some rule somewhere in the part of the brain that initiated the secretion of growth hormone, and there's got to be a way of transducing the sensor signal into shutting off the secretion. There's got to be projections, cables coming out of the part of the brain that's measuring the hormone, heading down onto their negative feedback regulation. And there's all sorts of fancy versions of it. You can have your set point change that happens during the ovulatory cycle, for example. The optimal level of estrogen is very different on day 0 versus day 14. You can have feedback systems that are responsive not just to the level of some hormone, but to the ratio of two hormones. Basically, though, it's great. What it is taking engineering principles and sticking it into physiology, showing that these systems make sense, showing that these physiological systems are tightly regulated. Selye loved this subject, and this actually makes a great deal of sense. You're Selye, starting the field in the 1930s, and as we talked about many lectures back, when he first proposed this stress concept, whether you're injured, starving, too hot, too cold, you turn on a very similar stress response. People, physiologists, thought he was out of his mind in the early years, and because of that principle we talked about earlier, when you have a specific problem in your body, you come up with a specific solution, and here's this non-specific stress response thing. Everybody thought Selye was a crackpot. And what they mostly thought was he was a type of crackpot who was not systematizing in his physiology, who was not organized, who was not hard-nosed, who was not following all sorts of rules about how physiological systems work. And not surprisingly, Selye had all this engineering, bioengineering envy. He wished that he could have the credibility in stress physiology of things being as clever and clear-cut as those negative feedback loops and the things that would make engineers happy. Fortunately, in the years subsequent to Selye and stress first bursting on the scene, fortunately, what began to emerge was lots of evidence suggesting that is just how the stress system worked. And this was enormously exciting to Selye and his disciples because the system was making sense. It was a regulated system. For example, you take an individual and experimentally you infuse them with a drug that drops blood pressure a tiny bit. And what you could then see is increased secretion of a hormone that counters this by increasing blood pressure. Now, instead of dropping blood pressure one smidgen and seeing one smidgen of this hormone coming out, you drop it two smidgens, and two smidgens of the hormone come out, and three and four and three and four. It was logical. There was this tight regulation. The amount of stressful challenge to the system in a very tightly predictable, organized regulatory way predicted the magnitude of the stress response. And this worked in all sorts of realms. You would stimulate, say, one pain receptor by pressing here, and the stress response of heart rate increasing would be one smidgen, and now you stimulate two pain receptors and it goes up a little more, and suddenly it was just like the greatest dream come true for the stress physiologist. They had to talk to mathematicians. They had to talk to statisticians. The field was becoming really hard-nosed, and this was wonderful. And Selye, this was just the golden age for stress physiology. And then something happened that ruined all the fun. And this came in the 1950s. You would do an experiment that in the stress regulatory bioengineering world, you knew exactly what was going to happen. For example, you have a test organism and you do something like what was just described. You have this much pressure placed on a pressure pain receptor and glucocorticoid levels go up this much, and the next individual you press this much and goes this much. The usual tight mathematical relationship. But now you do something a little different. And what you show is you have your test organism and you put in a certain stimulus of a certain intensity, and you've got your calculator and your abacus out there and counting your toes, and as a result you know exactly how much of an increase in stress hormone levels there should be, except something different happens. When you stress this organism, the organism has the opportunity to now get up and run over to mommy and hold on to her, and you don't secrete the glucocorticoids. This was flabbergasting. Nothing in Selye's wonderful clean world of stress responses being a tightly logically regulated engineering system as wonderful as a toilet bowl, nothing could have predicted this. This was horrifying. The notion that this tightly regulated system, this organism, goes and screws up everything by running over to mommy, and mommy would blunt the stress response. This was Very unexpected, obviously. And this was like the worst news that came down the pike for Celia in a long time. Because what do you do with this? This doesn't make any sense. Nothing could possibly explain the fact that this tightly regulated world, it was modulated instead by perception, by appraisal, by evaluation. And this was really quite shocking. We've seen one version of how this works, which is these appraisal factors, this world of running over to mommy, could modulate how the body would respond to a stressor. You put in a stressor, and suddenly some weird, untoiled, bolish variable like hugging mommy, and you would change the output. You could modulate the magnitude of the stress response by these appraisal evaluative factors. And there was a remarkable study showing this a few years ago, showing just how much of a stress response you can get. And this was like a remarkable study. This was published in the journal Science some years ago, and it showed some evidence for rat empathy. Here's what was done. You give a rat what's called a hot plate test, which is you put them on a perfectly cold surface, and you slowly begin to increase the temperature of this plate. And at the very point where it's gotten warm enough that the rat picks up a paw for the first time, take them off, and you've just finished the study. You've determined what their pain threshold is for this. And it's kind of distressing, but it's not massively so. So what you see in this study is you're doing this to one rat, and you put another rat right next to it, and you give it the same painful sort of stimulus. And what you see is if the first rat is getting exposed to the stressor, it lowers the pain threshold of the second rat right next to it. Some of the time. And here was the remarkable thing. Put two strange rats next to each other, and it doesn't work. Put two cage mates next to each other, and you get this empathic lowering of the threshold for the stress response. What have we got there? In rats, something akin to empathy. I know this rat, and this rat is giving off signals of being stressed. I am going to lower my threshold for my stress response. Modulating in the most unexpected realms. Go hug mommy and you don't secrete as many stress hormones. Go sit next to a rat that you know and liked that's getting exposed to its own stressor. You become more sensitive to stress. So modulatory factors. Then the most outrageous thing came along. People showing that you could turn on the stress response in the absence of any stressor, in the absence of any physical toilet bowlish sort of insult of this much of a drop in blood pressure or this much of a stim. You could turn the stress response on without anything happening physiologically. And to appreciate that, all you need to do is look at a classic demonstration of that. Sit there and watch a loved one go through a painful medical procedure, and your heart rate will increase, and your breathing rate will increase, and you are turning on a sympathetic nervous system stress response. What is this? This is the very core of this entire course, the notion that we smart humans, and even some other species as well, have the sophistication to turn on the stress response to circumstances that make no physiological sense. We could turn it on in response to psychosocial stressors. This was the establishment that this could go on. And Selye hated this. And during the 50s, there was this sort of wildly florid animosity that evolved between Selye and a man named John Mason at Yale, who was the one who did this pioneering work. And this was the battle between stress physiology as a tightly regulated engineering system and stress physiology as this mucky, weird world of mommies hugging test organisms. And in one very, very widely read debate that the two of them had in press, they like slashed at each other and argued about what sort of system the stress physiology system really is. The general consensus is that Mason mopped the floor with Selye because you couldn't look at results like mommy hugging and argue that the stress system is nothing but a tightly regulated engineering wonder. Selye managed to get a couple of hits in there at the end, pointing out there's a few cases where there's none of this appraisal yucky stuff happening. For example, anesthetize somebody for surgery and slice into their belly and you turn on a stress response. And no degree of mommy hugging them, no degree of framing of the experience, nothing is going to change that. Okay, so some of the time, the stress physiology system was responsive to the pure mechanical magnitude of the stressor, but the general view, though, was in all sorts of realms, the most common realms of the stress response, aspects of appraisal and evaluation and perception would greatly modulate the stress response. What have we just done here? What happened in the late 1950s? Suddenly, through the back door in the whole field, in snuck the psychologists. And suddenly, stress and disease and health was as much the purview of psychologists as it was of these hard-nosed endo-neuro-mechano-engineering types. And thus, the field was changed forever after. And once again, as the very core of this course, is the fact that when we think about our stressors, we are dumped into the world of psychology, stress and health, rather than the world of tightly regulated endocrine systems. And Selye was vanquished as a result, and apparently nursed a great grudge for the rest of his life about it. For everybody else in the field, slowly, those low-class, swarthy, unkempt psychologists slowly, you know, got some manners and some gray hair, and eventually were allowed to eat at the dinner table. And slowly, psychology has come to be viewed as at least as interesting in making sense of stress and disease as the purely mechanical aspects. So that moves us now to this critical issue of what is it about psychological context that is stressful? And what we're talking about here is what makes stress stress when it's psychological stress. We're talking about certain types of stressors. What we just saw was a stressor, a certain degree of stimulation, could be highly modulated by hugging mommy. Nonetheless, there are circumstances where it can't be modulated by psychological factors. Go outside for a walk to the supermarket, unexpectedly get gored by a rhino, and you're going to have a stress response. There's no degree of psychological reappraisal you can do. You can't decide, you know, this is a chance to grow from adversity, or I've always hated the shirt, so now I can finally throw it out. You're going to have a stress response. But when you get to the world of much more intermediate, moderate stressors, the capacity of psychological context to modulate is enormous. So thus we begin with this critical question, what is it about psychological context that makes some stressors more stressful and other ones less so? And what we'll see over this lecture and the next one, there are some very powerful psychological factors that modulate the stress response. First one, in the aftermath of a stressor, do you have an outlet? And this was work pioneered by Jay Weiss, then at Rockefeller University, now at Emory University. And here's the paradigm that he did. And just as a sort of note up front here, the experiments that dominate the next few days are, the next few lectures, are some rather painful ones to hear about. Hear these in the context of this is where the next antidepressant drug is going to be invented from information like this, psychological stressors. So here is what Jay Weiss would do. He would take a rat who would be exposed to a physical Selyean stressor. Every now and then, it would get a shock. And with enough of these, the rat would develop an ulcer. Now there's a second rat. Psychology jargon, the second rat is yoked to the first rat. Every time the first rat gets a shock, so does the second. Same intensity, same duration, same everything. According to Selye in 1930s, the two bodies are being knocked out of homeostatic balance to the exact same extent, except there's a critical difference, which is every time that second rat would get a shock, it could go over to a bar of wood and gnaw on it with its teeth, and it wouldn't get an ulcer. It had an outlet for the frustration caused by the stressor. And what soon emerged was the recognition that all sorts of outlets would work for a rat under those conditions. The rat going into a running wheel after shocks like that and running off the stressor, an outlet in that form. All of these overeating at that point, all of these would wind up protecting from a stress-related disease. Outlets. And then you look at the same thing in humans and you ask, well, are stressors capable of being modulated, being blunted by outlets in humans? That's hobbies. That's going for a run. That's working off the tension in a gym. That's screaming in the stairwells after that awful stressful meeting. Humans do the exact same thing. Why should this work? Why should physical outlets work, reduce the stress response after a stressor? For a number of reasons. First off, because it releases the muscle tension. Especially if it is a psychosocial stressor. Again, back to the very beginning, what's the stress response about? Getting your body ready to run, to sprint, all of that. And here you are having that all turned on for purely psychological reasons. Go exercise and you decrease that muscle tension. This is found in a particularly interesting realm. Now, throughout the early part of the course, a very similar metaphor kept coming up. The zebra running for its life away from the lion and needs its energy and its thigh muscles. Not all animals deal with predators that way. Consider, for example, gazelle. Gazelle are mostly hunted by cheetah. And what gazelles do, if there's a cheetah around, is they don't run away because cheetahs run faster. What they do is they crouch down and stay as still as possible in the hopes the cheetah won't spot them. In other words, the stress response in this case is not about running for your life. It's about being as still as possible and, if need be, a quarter second from now, beginning to run for your life. And it's a very different physiology, and it is demanding, even more so than the running for your life scenario, this absolute stillness amid this absolute preparative muscle tension. And what do you see after the cheetah disappears and the gazelle has gotten away with it? It gets up and it runs around like mad to dissipate some of that muscle tension. Why else do outlets work? Because they distract you. And that's what some of the most basic human hobbies are about. Why else do outlets work? Because if it's the right kind, they remind you about what's really important in life. They remind you, for example, that at the end of the day of rushing and traffic and striving and ambition and shallow, just, you know, wishing, coveting what everybody else has. After a day of that, at the end of the day and those stressors, if it's the right setting, you come home and have the outlet of playing with your children. And suddenly you remember what things really matter in life. So we've got this world of outlets. There's one type of outlet that pops up very frequently, and this is a really distressing one. Now you take the rat that is yoked to the first one, it gets the same shock, same intensity, all of that, and now what it's allowed to do after getting its shocks is run over to the other side of the cage where there's another rat it could sit down next to and bite the bejesus out of it. And you know what? This rat who's doing the biting isn't going to get an ulcer. He's got a particular type of outlet. He's doing displacement aggression onto an innocent bystander. And disturbingly, this works great. Among baboons, about half of aggression is displacement aggression. Male loses a fight, who chases a subadult, who bites a female, who lunges at a juvenile, who slaps an infant. What does that mean? At each one of those steps, an individual is taking the stressor, the frustration of what just occurred, and having an outlet, dumping it on somebody else. And this makes very disturbing sense. This is why during periods of economic duress, rates of child abuse, of spousal abuse go up. This is the world of displacing. Really, really depressing finding. And this came out of some of my work with baboons, wild baboons. You look at being a very stressed type of baboon, a relatively low ranking one, elevated glucocorticoid levels. You know the whole business by now. And what you see is the greater the tendency that baboon has to dump on somebody else, to displace aggression when something stressful has happened to them, the lower their glucocorticoid levels. In other words, this particular type of an outlet, displacing aggression onto an innocent bystander, is one of the most common and one of the most efficacious things that social organisms do to feel less stressed. really bad news. And it's the core behind one of the great truisms of stress management: don't avoid getting this ulcer by giving it to somebody else. Next variable, in addition to outlets, here's now the variable. You take the lab rat that's getting the same shocks, all that sort of deal, and now this time it could run over to the other side of the cage where there's a rat that it knows and it likes, and they groom each other and it doesn't get ulcers. Social support. And harking back to that empathy study, it's not just doing it with any rat. If it's a complete stranger of a rat, the logical thing to do is displace aggression on them. If it's a rat you know, the social support, the grooming there is protective. Same thing in baboons. What you see there is social grooming, and this is one of the archetypal things that non-human primates do, which is sitting around and taking the parasites off of each other and eating them. And what's grooming good for? And all the initial theories were, number one, if you're being groomed, it reduces your ectoparasite load. Number two, if you're grooming somebody else, you get all this great nutrition from eating the little ticks and stuff in your life. That's got nothing to do with it. When you look at how grooming works, what it is social calming. It's stress reduction. You get a baboon who has just had a scare. A lion has almost gotten him. And what does he do afterward? He runs over and grooms somebody. You get the entire troop where something scary has happened. Some lion has leapt out and everybody just barely made it into the trees. And when the lion is gone, everybody comes down and sits and grooms for the next half hour. It is very socially calming. And a remarkable study done a few years ago by Dorothy Cheney and Robert Seyfarth at the University of Pennsylvania, looking at baboons and one of the worst stressors that could happen to any female primate, your child has died. And what they show is for quite a long period afterward, elevated glucocorticoid levels in these females, and the more grooming they did, the less it rose. What does it look like in humans? Obviously, this is the whole world of social affiliation, and we are going to come back and look at it like crazy. It's also pertinent in all sorts of very acute circumstances. Take somebody going through a short medical procedure that's kind of stressful. Take somebody go through an experimental stressor, rapid mathematics pressure, and have somebody there they know and like and hold their hand, and they don't have as much of a stress response. Social support as a highly protective factor. Next one, predictability. Predictability. Back to those two rats, both getting shocks, and now the second rat, 10 seconds before each shock, a little warning light comes on, and the rat doesn't get the ulcer. Predictive information. Enormously powerful in that regard. And we know that principle. It tells you when something bad is coming, how bad is it going to be, how long is it going to last, how severe, what it's like afterward. And what that does is it allows you to plan coping strategies. We all know that principle and we use it all the time. Every time you're sitting there in the dentist chair and you say, are we almost done? Give me some predictive information. And we all know the difference between the dentist that says two more bits of drilling and the one that says two, I don't know, you could be here for weeks. What does predictive information do there? Lots of things. One of the things it affords you is the ability to plan your coping strategy during the stressor. And that's one that's very effective, knowing that this stressor is going to last for 4.5 days versus 3 seconds. That's very useful to know. That allows you to plan your effective coping strategy. And you even see this in the realm. Somebody is going through a surgical procedure, and what they tell you is the first day or so, it's going to hurt like crazy, and by the second day, you're just going to be uncomfortable and tired. What that tells you is your coping strategies, you should plan on watching the exciting, you know, tawdry adventure action movies the first day and work on your composing those delicate haikus the second day instead of the other way around. It allows you to plan your coping strategy. What it also allows you to do is know when the stressor is over with, when you're finally safe. For that rat getting the shocks without any warning light coming on, any second you could be a half second away from the next stressor. So this is an extremely powerful principle in terms of being told, When is it going to happen? How bad is it going to be? How long is it going to last? And that works as effectively in a human, a non-human primate, a rat. So in all of them, it is a very powerful variable for controlling things. And that whole notion that what predictability allows you to do is know what your coping strategy is going to be, know how long the stressor is going to last. That's the principle behind one of the most painful, one of the most central, one of the most defining, one of the most poignant questions any of us might ever ask somewhere down the line, which is, how much time do I have left? So what we've seen here now is the first of the powerful psychological variables, powerful, the defeat of Hans Selye and the psychologist suddenly taking over the whole field, and the starts of these variables, what is it that makes psychological stress stressful? For the same degree of objective challenge to the system, you are more likely to subjectively feel stressed, more likely to activate the stress response, more likely to get a stress-related disease if you lack outlets for the frustration caused by the stressor, if you lack social support, and if you lack predictive information. So at this point, it seems like there's a very clear take-home message from this lecture, which is when stress hits, get as many outlets as possible and get as much predictive information as possible and try to socialize with everybody on earth. And what you're going to see is that's what you take as the lesson here. It's not going to do you any good. What works, what buffers the stress response, is far more subtle psychological variables. And that's what we'll consider in the next lecture.
Lecture 18, Psychological Modulators of Stress.
Well, it's dawn here at the teaching company. The cows have been milked. Things are going terrifically. Over last night, the sound technician switched me from New York accent to the lovely, lilting Scottish brogue you're hearing now. And thus, we are ready to plow into the next subject. The next subject being the second half of last lecture. What the last lecture did was introduce us to the piece of history, the loves of Hans Selye, the hatreds of Hans Selye, the great triumph Trojan Greek battle between Selye and the psychologist, and the emergence of the recognition of how important psychological factors are in modulating the stress response. That transitioned us to the absolutely critical question, what is it about psychological stress that is stressful? And we covered the first three of some of the key variables, the role of outlets for frustration, the role of social support, the role of predictability, and what we do now is continue in some more of those key factors. The next one is a biggie, which is a sense of control. General rule, and we will see soon how impossibly simplistic that general rule is, but the general rule is the more of a sense of control, the less stressful a stressor is. Now, you can show this pretty cleanly with a lab rat, the same sort of experiments as in the last lecture. In this case, though, a rat who will be getting shocks now and then has been trained to press a lever. And by pressing the lever, it decreases the likelihood of getting a shock. So here's what's happening. Scenario number one, you've trained that rat to be able to do that, and the rat gets put back into the room where it gets the shocks, except you've taken away the lever. The lever isn't there, and the rat has a massive stress response, far more so than it would have gotten had it not gotten that lever training. And it's obvious what it's doing. It's sitting there saying, give me the damn lever. I know exactly what to do to get this under control. And it has lost the opportunity to do that. Or you could see the flip side of it. Now you've got the rat who's been trained to press the lever and back there in the room and getting the shocks and the lever's there. But today you've disconnected the lever. It's doing nothing. It's placebo. Pressing it doesn't at all decrease the likelihood of a shock. But the rat's in there pounding away on the lever saying, this is great. Just imagine how many shocks I'd be getting otherwise. It thinks it has a sense of control. And what we see here is the power of control to modulate the stress response. A very, very potentially powerful one. Okay, so what else can you say about control? What else can you do in terms of making sense of it? You begin to transition to what does this look like in humans? And remarkably, it looks exactly the same. A study done by Owen Walkowitz at UCSF, and what he did was essentially translate the rat study into humans. Volunteers sitting in a room, and every now and then, unpredictably, there would be a blast of high decibel noise, very unpleasant, up goes blood pressure. Now, instead, the volunteer is sitting there, and they've been told, by pressing this little button here, you decrease the likelihood of the blast of noise happening, and you don't get as much of a rise in blood pressure amid the exact same number of those shocks. Same deal as in the rats. Same exact model. And you can see this playing out as well in all sorts of human occupations, a realm of occupational psychology, stress management, and an awful lot of what it's about is the amount of control you have in your workplace. Now, to begin to make sense of this, we have to start with one of the great myths of stress physiology, and this is the myth of the executive stress syndrome. And this emerged in the 1950s, a study that ostensibly showed that having a high degree of control of responsibility ulcerated you like crazy. This was a study where there would be two monkeys that would get shocks now and then, and one of them had the power, by pressing a lever over and over and over, to decrease the likelihood of both of them getting shocks. And what they showed was this executive monkey with his hands at the wheel of the ship and captain of his own fate and this other one's fate would have more stress-related diseases. Ah, executive stress. And this permeated through everybody's consciousness, especially sort of the bloated robber barons who say, oh my God, now it turns out that yacht is not such a great thing because I am under so much stress. What a victim I am. It turned out there was an extremely flawed piece of that study, and that the researchers, for typical reasons, wanted to get a good result and wanted to get it quickly. So what they said was, hey, why don't we pick out the monkeys who seem to be the most hyper-emotional and reactive, and we'll make them the executive monkeys. And no wonder they got the stress-related disease. They had blown the design. They didn't randomize the subjects. So that trashes the notion of the executive stress syndrome. Who do you actually see getting stress-related diseases in the large corporate world? It's not upper management. It's middle management. It's middle management because of a key feature about life in the middle there, which is you have high demand and low control. High demand in that you've got to do all sorts of difficult things. You're in a position of great responsibility. Low control because you're not the one making up the policy. You're getting the orders from on up high. It's middle management that has the most problems with stress-related disease. And when you look at individuals, it's the ones who most interpret their job as involving low control, high responsibility, high demand, who get into trouble. Second on the list of bad work scenarios would be ones where you have the combination now of low demand, low control. Because now you've got the double whammy of lack of control in your life plus boredom. And what's the best possible way of framing all of this? And these are the folks with high demand and high control. And this is typically upper management. This is the folks running things. And as long as this is them doing some sort of job that they like, and it's usually some sort of job that they're obsessively attached to, the high degree of control and the high degree of demand is a great combination. Now, this came through subtly in a fascinating study that was done some years ago. And it had a very atypical pair of authors. One of the giants of behavioral endocrinology was a man named Seymour Levine at Stanford University. Everyone knew him as Gig. And Gig Levine published a paper with his son. His son, who was not a scientist. His son, who was a professional musician, who played in, I believe, the Minneapolis Symphony. And they did the following study. They looked at patterns of stress, subjective senses of stress, health, all of that, in two groups of musicians. those playing professionally in symphony orchestras, those playing professionally in small ensembles, string quartets, things of that sort. They did all the same controls on their lab rat musicians that they should have done. They matched the two groups for the total amount of time they travel, for income, all of that. The sole difference was these guys were playing in a symphony and these guys were playing chamber music. And what they saw was the chamber music folks were far less stressed. What's this about? One of the things that's constantly emphasized when people think about successful aging is the remarkable longevity of symphony conductors, and they're all conducting into their 90s, and they've got the perfect job, which we will get to in a few lectures. They've got the aerobic exercises we've heard, but they also have control. They're the head of the orchestra, and what that often translates into is a miserable lack of control on the part of the instrumentalists in there, because the conductor controls everything. It was, in fact, not until that many years ago that unions of orchestral musicians got the right to demand bathroom breaks with some regularity. Look at this. You're an adult playing there, and the conductor is the one who decides when the oboe people can go to the potty. Marked lack of control versus chamber musicians, far more control as to what's going on in their lives. This is also thought to be a factor, this combination of high demand, high control, of people who thrive in one of the all-time stressful occupations, people who are air traffic controllers. And a researcher named Robert Rose spent much of his career looking at the physiology of the stress response in air traffic controllers and trying to figure out how that maps on to job performance. And apparently there's essentially a bimodal shift, two separate profiles of air traffic controllers. There's the ones who come in and after a remarkably short number of months are sopping, stressed messes and can't continue the job. And then there are ones who just go on for decades and are great at it. What's the difference? And what he saw was a very different style of how they did the work, a very different way of doing it. You had the folks who lasted almost no time at all, and what you would see is the morning they were going to work to do whatever shift it was, they already had an elevated stress response blasting through the roof. They get into their job, stress response is still way up there. They finish the job, and hours later, they're still recovering from the stress response. We should know by now that's not a harbinger of a good outcome. And then you look at the folks who did wonderfully, who lasted forever, and what you would see is up to 3 seconds before they would sit down in the chair and start working, no stress response, everything fine, start the stressful work, blast it through the roof, and the second it's over with, they're off thinking about dinner. What they're doing is having a stress response only when it was needed. What these people are about was having an enormously highly demanding job, but what they tended to also see psychologically was they viewed themselves as having a lot of control, and that took away the psychological stress of the anticipation they're recovering from. So that's this key variable of control. On to the next variable, and this is a rather subtle one, a perception as to whether things are getting worse or getting better. Let me give you an example of this in the experimental realm. Two rats. First day, one of them gets 50 shocks. The next day, it gets 25. In other words, a total of 75 shocks. Meanwhile, over here is the rat who's getting 10 shocks the first day and 25 the next. Total of 35 shocks, 75 versus 35. Who's more stressed? It's absolutely obvious the guy's gotten a total of 75, far more shocks than this guy. No, that's not what you see. Who has worse stress response? The guy going from 10 to 25. The one going from 50 to 25 is sitting there saying, 25, piece of cake, this is fabulous. Things are getting better. So what you see is this very important variable. It's not just how much of a stressor there is, but it's which direction are you coming to in order to get to that stressor. Now, you can show this also in a very subtle study that I did with my baboons some years ago. Okay, you've got dominance hierarchies. You've got number 1 and number 10 and number 20. And the quality of life is very different depending on your dominance rank. And high-ranking guys very aggressively enforce their high rank. Except every now and then, the ranks change. In other words, every now and then, the relationship between two baboons with their known ranking difference becomes unstable and maybe even changes. So what does stability look like? You see the interactions between this pair of baboons, number 5 and number 6, and number 5 is winning 95% of the interactions with number 6. That's stable. In contrast, number 5 and number 6, number 5 is winning 51% of the interactions with number 6. What's that about? That's an unstable dyad. They might very well be just about to flip. And thus, what we begin to see is an issue of control, predictability, stability. Nice, stable relationships are much more predictable. Suddenly, you would come up with this prediction that, well, instability in and of itself is a stress.